I'm Rodney Ungulak Awalka. And I'm from Gamble. I was born May 8, 1942, here in Gamble, right at home, I guess. No electricity, no vehicles, no outside lights like right now. Like I said, no electricity, so I remember we had Aladdin lamps, kerosene lamps, and then a little later on, gas lanterns came around. That was bright compared to Aladdin lamps. And I remember in our winter house seeing two ceiling oil lamps, because it was used for both heat and light. So back then, blubber was very precious. Well, in the winter time, it's frozen, right? So they had a kind of pounder to make it softer. In the meantime, the oil would be rendered like slush ice or something, but then they still put it in a pot and they heated it up. And that rendered the oil from the blubber itself. When it cooled, they poured it into the seal oil lamp. Apparently it was clay. There's clay here in the island, so they know where to get them. I guess they formed it and cooked it like it. They hardened clay. And the seal oil lamp had moss for a wick. Yeah. Used for both heat and light. Those seal oil lamps are on 24 hours a day. Yeah, just before my mom went to bed, she formed a wick so it'll be nice and, you know, uniform. Depending on the size of the seal oil lamp, I guess I'd say it's about 6 to 8 inches wide. It'd have a nice, level light. Well, I remember my mom and dad would wake me up early in the morning, in the fall time, September, most likely. You know, they're shuffling around, let's like a thump here and there on it, you know, knock or something. A little noise like that would wake me up. Apparently what they were doing, my dad was getting ready to go hunting, dog team by dog team. I'd wake up, it was still dark, just about dawn. But I'd hear the village dogs barking away. About 800 of them somewhere there in the village. They were a necessity back then. They were a form of transportation. So they would be barking away. The village would be nice and quiet while they hear hundreds of dogs barking. They knew what was happening. They're going out. They're going to be running as a team. And my dad would get ready, and by the time it was dawn, you know, he'd go out and apparently put the harness on the dogs. In the meantime, the howling and barking would go down, down, down. As the dog teams, the man with the dog team went out one right after the other, less and less dogs barking. So by the time it's daylight, nice and quiet, my mom would put my boots on, my parka, and I'd go out, and I remember it's nice and quiet, no more barking, quiet. That's how quiet it was. It's a simple, slow life compared to today. I remember There used to be a lot more seal because of the quiet, you know. I remember I'd wake up, we had a canvas tent, 8x10 frame. I'd wake up in the morning, my dad would be out there on the seal line, my mom doing something, cooking, and I'd get up, have a cup of tea, and I'd hear a shot. A few minutes later, my mom would say, "Hey, go help your dad." No machines, you know. So I'd walk over, and in the meantime, he'd tie the seal to a piece of rope and put it on the rope on his shoulder and pull it, you know. So I'd walk over and help him pull it to the, our camp. And so I'd go in and continue my cup of tea, and my dad would do something and then walk over again. By the time I'm doing my second cup, I'd hear another bang. Probably about 45 minutes later, again my mom would say, "You need to go help your dad." That's how much sealed were around, because of the quiet and no noise pollution or light pollution. Right now, five different planes come out here at least twice a day. There's red lights on towers around and that airport beacon. So therefore, game is further out. Every evening, my father would close the window with a formed wood or plywood or something, cover the windows. So I asked him, "Why do we do that?" I remember him saying, "So the game out there won't see the light." Apparently, gamble would blackout. Most everybody did that, apparently, so the sea mammals out there won't see the light, he says, so therefore the game was a lot closer back then. But now, like I say, there's planes coming in, lights 24 hours a day, so they're out for the, after at least, I don't know, about 12, 14 miles out now to start to see sea mammals. Being from an island, we have stronger family ties. Being isolated, I guess. We had a small family. As a matter of fact, there were only four of us. My mom was in Savunga. She had a son and lost her husband, and she moved over here, and my father married her. My dad taught me how to hunt. Of course, he taught my stepbrother, older brother, he was the one that, when we started going out by lund boats, he was at the helm, you know, the captain. So we learned from him. Hunters, a tradition out there, any hunter, a good hunter will give pointers to the young hunter going out there for the first time. So you get your hunting skill not just from your immediate family, like your dad or uncle or immediate relative, but the tradition is any hunter out there will tell them that this is the way it's done, you know. So in other words, our lifestyle is being verbally or by example being passed on. good example is my grandson, oldest grandson, he's 13 years old now. Last year, 2 years ago, he got his first muckluck with his own very own rifle. Food on the table. He was pretty excited. But, you know, our lifestyle being is passed on, you know, like male people. We have to go out hunt for our daily food. As a matter of fact, that we get as much as we can for, you know, following year, because our source of food comes by here only once a year in the springtime. I like the way a barrel captain explained our lifestyle here. One boat captain says, you people down there in the lower 48 or wherever, you have garden, right? So every spring you plant the seeds, and when they grow, you gather from it for the year. We have a garden too up here, you know, but our garden is out there in the sea, in the Bering Sea. We have only one time every year to gather our food, which is sea mammal. That's our garden out there. I like the way he explained it. Came here to Alaska, and I went to every village and built a school. There was only one couple, a man and a woman, who taught grade school. Apparently the lady taught the first three grades, I guess, and then the husband taught the fourth on up to the eighth grade. So I went to a, you know, Bureau of Indian Affairs school when I was 6 years old. That would have been 1948. Our native language was mostly used. I remember the very first time I went to school, first grade. My mom took me to the school there, and I sat on the assigned desk, and the lady started talking English. I didn't understand one word of what she was saying. So I learned how we had to learn from scratch, speaking English. And then after grade school, there was no high school here like it is, there is now. I had to fly out to Mount Edgecombe, across Sitka, for high school. Because of the fact that we live here on an island, isolated, we had strong family ties. And when I went to high school, that was the very first time I left the island and my family. I was homesick for 3 months. So I just had to psych myself, you know, told myself, hey, you're here for a reason, to get an education, you know, try to forget my homesickness, start concentrating on schooling. We only had skin boats, wood frame, and covered with walrus skin. Apparently, female skin was preferred because I think it had less pores on it compared to male skin. What they did, though, was the skin is so, its size is so much, you can make it into probably Oh, I'd say about 10 by 14 size skin stretched out. But what they did, they split it in half. So the square footage will be doubled. It's amazing. And still, it took two skins to cover a boat. It's a skill. It takes skill to split a walrus hide in two, you know, in the middle. That's an art. I mean, that's a skill. But back then, our skid boats were used all year round. But now they're traditionally used for whaling. When the skin boat used to be used year round, the skin on the average would last about 5 years. So on the average, every 5 years you have to replace it. Because when you get some walruses out there, you have to butcher it, right? And then you have to put it into the boat. And the blood and the blubber being rubbed onto the skin kept it softer, so it'd last about 5 years. But since we got Lund boats and we used the skin boats for traditionally for whaling, that's one time a year, and then the rest of the time they're up on the racks. So on the average you have to be replaced every 3 years, because they're just sitting there idle and the sun dries up the skin. The very first time I got a seal for was from the shoreline over at my camp. I was probably about, like my grandson, I was probably about 12 years, somewhere there, 14. My father gave me a rifle. Taught me how to handle it for safety reasons and so forth, you know, how to take care of it, you know, taking it apart and wiping it clean, oiling it and everything. Open sight, no scopes. And so we were over there at camp, and my father was a councilman. He said, oh, I'm going to walk home to attend a meeting tonight. So when he did, I went over to his favorite seal blind, as I call it. And by golly, I think about an hour later, but I saw a seal pretty close. But I remember it's only about 200 feet out. So I got ready, and I saw it again, and I shot it. It didn't run away, it didn't splash. And then the next wave come around, well, by golly, I saw it. That was my first seal. We were at camp there, and I remember my mom telling me, smiling at me, you know, "Man, you get a seal even when your dad's not here," you know, something like that, you know. I remember smiling at her, and she's smiling back at me, you know. Good feeling for a young man like me bringing in the first food on the table, you know. The wind has to be coming in from the sea to the shore, so the seal will drift in. And most of the time, the breakers on the shore sinks it. So we have what you call seal hooks. So we have to try and hook it before it actually washes the shore, because it might sink. So I think about 50 feet out, we start using the seal hook. It's made out of wood, shaped like a bowling pin. And a bowling pin, you know, the largest part is on the floor standing up, but the smaller end is up. That's where we tied a line to it. They put three hooks on the larger part of the pin there, and that's what you call a seal hook. It takes skill. It takes skill to throw that hook. It'll go over, just over the seal. So it'll land just over the seal, and you just slowly pull it in until you feel a tug, and you give it a jerk so the hook will go into through the skin, and then you pull it in. Oh my gosh, a good hunter will probably get maybe about 20, 30 seals in one season. Of course, we get seals mostly all year round. But on the ice, you're not going to get seal. You can get mukluks too, which is called a bearded seal. And the tradition out here too is that when you get a bearded seal, a mukluk out there, out in the water, you have to pull it on the ice to butcher it, right? And the tradition is, when you see another boat coming by, you beckon them, you call them in. You automatically know we got a mukluk, because the tradition is whoever comes around, you give them half, about 300-400 pounds of meat. Good size seal. Here in the village, everybody's taken care of. Some family whose husband is sick or something, they can't go out hunting, they run out of food or something. Back then, no problem. The lady of the house would go next door to the other clan and ask, hey, we need food. Can you have some? No problem. If we have it, we give them. So when we get a walrus, we come back in, so all the people on the crew members get a share, so therefore the families have food. So every time it's favorable, the hunters go out. And then in the springtime, somebody gets a whale, that's a village affair. Takes everybody, every young man, able-bodied man to help out in butchering the whale. That's why I say it's a village affair, the whole village, even the women, children, go out there to watch. The whale, to date, I never have seen the ear of a whale. It's a pinhole size ear. And apparently the whale has very sensitive hearing. It's out in the sea, right? It can hear natural sound, a little rustling of the water, and the ice hitting each other out there. It's its environment, so it knows a familiar sound. But when you hear a thump, it'll scurry away like a fish. That's why we use sails to hunt the whale. The whale is going from south to north, migrating from the south to north. So most of the time we look with binoculars to the south and we first see a spout. There are in the meantime about a 6 to 12 or more, maybe as much as 30 boats out there, whale for whaling. We try to see which way it's gonna go. The closest boat apparently is the one that tries to get to it. When it becomes imminent that we're gonna get close to it, everybody just stays quiet. Because there's a person that's assigned to throw the buoy, or back then it used to be a seal poke. When the striker does strike the whale, they throw it over. The line is attached to a seal poke for drag. Underwater, they apparently move, you know, wobble, and produce drag to slow down the whale. Of course, the first time you strike it, those buoys or pokes are pulled down underwater. And most of the time, the whale is going north, so it's a northerly direction. So the boats look at where the whale went down. Apparently, just when the whale is coming up, the pokes come up first. They're very buoyant. So I guess some of them, sometimes they even jump off the surface of the water, I think. You can see them. And then the striker guides a boat captain who's controlling the rudder. He beckons, the striker beckons with his head, you know. If he wants him to turn the boat left, turns his head left, right, go to the right. Ideally, when it's imminent that we're going to get to a whale, the boat captain concentrates on his striker, not the whale. He concentrates on his striker. He looks at him. Which way am I going to turn? So when they do strike the whale, they drop the sail, and then they pull up an extra poke up to the top of the mast to signal the other boats we got a whale. Now we have CBs who can communicate, so everybody knows. When the whale is slowed down enough, the boat captain that got the whale, you know, he'd ask that man, okay, I want you to kill it for me. Apparently that expert knew the anatomy of the whale pretty well, so he knew where the heart is in there. So here again, it takes skill. What I learned is the most important thing is our way of life, our traditional life is important to us. We live a subsistence lifestyle out here, passing on down knowledge and traditions was only by mouth, you know. So it's important that we keep passing it on. Our way of life here, one way of life we know, subsistence lifestyle. We live off the sea, mammals, and the land. Apparently God has provided enough nutrition for us, you know, from both the land and the sea. Our way of life is important to be passed on to the younger generation for identity, who we are.